Welcome to Orphans No More, a radio extension of Justice for Orphans Ministry, a program dedicated to rally the church for the cause of the fatherless, advocating Christian families to adopt and get involved with foster care here in the Capital District, as well as globally, and encouraging and supporting those who've heard and heeded the call of James 1:27.
Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, submit to Him, and He will make your path straight. That is Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. I'm your host, Sandra Flack, and this is Orphans No More, a media extension of Justice for Orphans Ministry. Joining us today is author, blogger, and adoptive mom, Rachel Garlinghouse. Welcome to the show, Rachel.
Thank you for having me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you as a guest on our show. And you're not just an adoptive mom, but you're an infant, open, domestic, transracial adoptive mom. And we're going to kind of unpack all that as we have our conversation today. But let's begin at the beginning with the why you and your husband, Steve, pursued adoption.
Absolutely. So Steve and I got married when I was 21.
Me too. I got married at 21.
Years. I know. I was a baby.
We were babies.
I was a baby. And he was 3 years older than I was. And we had been married about 5 years. And I had experienced a virus. And after that virus, was just really sick for about a year and a half. So I went to 5 different medical professionals and had multiple misdiagnoses, including anorexia, being a hypochondriac, and it turned out I wasn't a hypochondriac. My husband took me to the ER one day because I couldn't breathe, and we found out that I have type 1 diabetes, which is an autoimmune disease where your body ceases to make insulin. So in that moment, I was on my deathbed, and I, as I'm in the ICU, doctors come in, and they keep telling me, we can't believe you're alive. Like, my body was toxic. It was shutting down. How did I live this way for so long? So it was probably 2 days into my hospital stay when a diabetes nurse educator came into my room and she said, do you plan on having children? And we said yes. And she went on to talk about type 1 diabetes and pregnancy. And I don't know why, Sandra, but it was interesting that, you know, nothing was clear at that point in my life. I felt like the floor had fallen out from underneath my feet. But in that moment, the word adoption came into my mind, and I knew we would adopt. I mean, immediately, I knew that we would adopt. And that's the plan that we ended up going with.
Wow. So there's lots of different avenues to take when you're going to pursue adoption. What led you to domestic adoption?
Well, it's interesting you asked me that. We started out pursuing international adoption through Guatemala, and that program closed about 2 months after we had decided that we were ready to pursue adoption. So I had a cousin adopted from Guatemala, and I thought, of course we'll go to Guatemala. It seemed like an easy decision. However, once that program closed, we were uncertain what we would do after that. So then we decided to look into domestic infant adoption, and we were actually open to an infant or a toddler in that point. But domestic adoption was kind of our second choice. But it ended up being the way that we adopted all 4 of our kids.
And yeah, you adopted 4 babies who are now presently 9, 7, 5, and 15 months old. They all came home within a couple of weeks of being born, and they're all transracial. So would you, Rachel, explain to our listeners what that means and what that's like considering, you know, what's going on in our country today?
Right. So our adoptions are transracial. My husband and I are both white. All 4 of our kids are black. And when we went to adopt, we were open to a child of any race. In fact, our profile when we waited 14 months for our first child was always shown for expectant parents who were pregnant with Caucasian boys. So Steve and I just thought, apparently we're adopting a Caucasian boy. And every time that we weren't chosen or the expectant parents had the baby and chose to parent, it was just, you know, this long agonizing wait. And then interestingly, we got a call one day when we were painting our kitchen for an African-American little girl who had already been born. And they said, do you want your profile shown? And we said, sure. And 2 hours later, they called us back and said, come get your baby. So
wow.
it was because we had an African-American child from the beginning that we were chosen subsequently because the birth parents of each of our kids wanted their child to have siblings who looked like them. So it was interesting that because our first adoption was an African-American child, all of our subsequent adoptions, even though we were open to a child of any race, were all African-American babies.
Wow. And none of the children are actually siblings biologically, correct? They're all separate adoptions.
Correct. They are four separate adoptions. Yes.
All right. So what is that like? You walk into a restaurant, you're two white parents and you have four black children in our country in this day and age. What kind of experiences do you have?
You know, it's been a range of experiences. We've had everything from people saying, God bless you, I think because they assume our kids were adopted maybe through foster care or from a difficult situation. We've had people say, which is the best thing that people can say, in my opinion, is you have a beautiful family. But we've also got a lot of questions. And some of them are not too kind. Like, we had a cashier ask us, how could someone give away such beautiful children right in front of my children? Mm. Or I think the question that's probably most bothersome to us is, are our kids real? That word, Sandra, are our kids real siblings? And I always say, of course they're real siblings, and we're their real parents. Like, it's, you know, it's all pretty real as they're pulling each other's hair and wrestling in the Target aisle. Like, it's all pretty real. So, you know, but it's been interesting. We've encountered a couple of, you know, situations definitely involving racism. Someone called my then 2-year-old son at the time a cute little thug. And this was around the time we're from the St. Louis area, when Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson. So there was a lot of racial tension in the St. Louis area more than ever before. And it just came out of this woman's mouth. Like, she didn't even think twice. She said, a cute little thug. And I thought, you're calling my 2-year-old baby a thug? I mean, so that had happened. And there was another time that my girls were riding bikes in the driveway, again, not too long after Ferguson. And my girls were riding bikes in the driveway. I was checking my work email on my cell phone, and a young man, Caucasian man, drove past our driveway in a pickup truck, leaned out his truck window, and screamed the N-word at my girls twice. And that feeling and that happens is just, and it happens to black families all the time. I mean, this is not, but as a Caucasian person who didn't grow up, obviously black and will never be black, this was like, holy moly. And of course they're my baby. So my mama bear just kicked in.
Sure.
So I think we've had a gamut of experiences. Some very, very positive. People come up and tell me their adoption stories all the time. They'll tell me, you know, my sister was adopted, or, you know, we were thinking about adoption, but we also have people who are just very, very rude. And unfortunately, Sandra, I think that's just life when it comes to anything.
Yeah.
It's just, there are rude people and there are kind people, and we just offer a lot of grace. And sometimes when negative things happen, we have been known to say, that's none of your business, or just walk away from a conversation, or, you know, just, we understand that we need to lead our kids by example, and that we are teaching them how to respond to people. And we've taught our kids that it's okay to not answer nosy questions or to respond to rudeness, that it's okay just to walk away from that. So yeah, our experience has been, it's been about a decade in the adoption community, and it's been very interesting.
Yeah, so how do you teach your kids to not, that they don't have to answer rude questions, and how do your kids take it? And you know, have you ever actually said something to a rude person who's, you know, made one of these horrible comments?
Yeah, I'll give you an example. We were leaving, my second daughter is amazing at basketball. She's the only girl on the all-boy team every time, and she can light up a court pretty good. So we were leaving a basketball game one day, and a woman, a Caucasian woman, probably in her mid-60s, kind of blocked us from leaving our row at the end of the game. And I looked at her like, okay, she was kind of in our personal space, and it was weird, and she just started interrogating us. Oh, are those your kids? I'm like, yes. And she's like, you know, oh, were they adopted? And I said, yes. And she just kind of kept going, and I gave her that look like, maybe you should stop. And then she just kept going. And I finally said to her, you know, nothing you're asking me is any of your business. Because she just started asking questions about my kids, you know, personal adoption stories. And later I brought it up to my girls, and I said, did you hear what happened? They were standing right next to me, and they said, yes. And I said, that lady was being inappropriate. She was basically being a bully. And I said, she was using her adult status and her size and her, you know, the fact that she's older than us and older than you guys to try to make you answer questions. And I said, that's inappropriate. And she didn't have the right to do that. And I said, did you hear what mommy said to that lady? And my second daughter said, "You told her, that's none of your business." And I thought, you know, I don't, as women, we're definitely, I feel like, taught to be polite and kind and less confrontational than men typically. And in that moment, I'm really proud of what I said to that woman, because I thought at first, should I say that? That's so rude. And then I thought, I just taught my kids a really powerful lesson in that moment. So there have been times I say that's none of your business, or there's been times I just walk away. Like, if it's just getting to be too much, we just walk away from the conversation. This doesn't happen often. I would say once every 6 months or once a year. But when it does happen, my kids are right by me and they're waiting to see how mommy's going to respond. So it's, you know, it's been very, very interesting.
Yeah. So now in this climate, how do you racially affirm your kids? Because that's important.
Yes.
Right?
It's very, very, very important. Yeah. This is what I write and talk about probably the most. We do a lot of things, and it's a really, you know, extensive conversation, but I'll give you a summary. So there's some things we do. Our kids have always had a mentor. So we, they have a, my girls, my older two girls have a Black female Christian mentor. And we found her through a local college. And so that's been really positive. They have Black hairstylists and Black barbers who do their hair. We purposefully try to find doctors of color or racial role models. All of my kids, fortunately, I've got four kids, three different schools. They all have principals of color, which is fantastic for my kids. Their pediatrician is an Asian woman, so not just necessarily their same race, but we work really hard to show them people of color in powerful, influential positions who are positive racial role models. So we do that. And then, of course, there's, you know, a lot of art in our home, books, toys, music. We try everything we can to affirm. And then the biggest thing is to have a diverse group of friends for ourselves. So our kids don't just need to look up to someone, you know, a wonderful Black role model. Let's talk about Serena Williams, right? Like, look how amazing of a tennis player she is, and she's a new mom, and, you know, that's great. But my kids need to see people who look like them on a day-to-day basis. So those are just some of the ways that we affirm our kids.
Mm. Well, let me just remind our listeners that this is Orphans No More, a media extension of Justice for Orphans Ministry. To learn more about adoption, foster care, and orphan ministry, visit our website at justicefororphansny.org. Our guest today is author, blogger, and infant, open, domestic, transracial, adoptive mom, Rachel Garlinghouse. Rachel is author of 6 books, including The Hopeful Mom's Guide to Adoption and the devotional Encouragement for the Adoption and Parenting Journey, which she co-authored with Madeline Melcher, another recent guest on this show. So Rachel is also a blogger at whitesugarbrownsugar.com. And we were just talking about, Rachel, how you racially affirm your children by maintaining, giving them role models and close relationships with people of color. So what about their birth families? Because these are all open adoptions, which means there's some contact with birth families. So are all 4 of your adoptions open? And explain for our listeners what open adoption is and what's your experience been with it?
Yeah, so open adoption basically means that the family who adopted the child and the birth family have some sort of communication. And that is a huge spectrum of different ways you can communicate and have that openness. So some families maybe text each other, some have visits, some exchange information through the adoption agency. So it really just varies. But our 4 adoptions are all open, meaning our kids see their birth families. And we do some texting, some obviously face-to-face meetings. We send them pictures. It's really whatever works at that time for each individual child.
And how did that start? Did you go into domestic adoption figuring you would do open adoption?
I did not. Steve and I thought we'll do a semi-open adoption, which means just sending some information through the agency so the birth parents know how the child's doing. And we chose that out of ignorance. We did not understand open adoption. We were scared of open adoption because we thought, does this mean we're sharing our child? Does this mean, you know, the child's going to be confused, like, who's mom and dad? That changed when we met our oldest daughter's biological mother, in the courtroom when we were going to court to gain guardianship of our oldest daughter. And all of a sudden, I mean, I just wanted to keep the door halfway open and to really play it safe, but the door was kicked open in that moment. And our adoptions have all been open since. Now, I will tell you, open adoption is complicated and bittersweet, and it requires a lot of patience and grace and willingness to change and flexibility. But I will argue that all good relationships, let's talk about marriage, require the same thing. So I think I owe it to my kids to do the best job that I can. And if that means open adoption, or we do think it means that in our case, then so be it. We'll put forth the effort, because we never want to keep our kids away from their biological families. There's no reason to have that, because we have the ability to see them and talk to them and for our kids to have a relationship with them. And that kind of takes away some of the shame and secrecy in adoption when there's not a lot of mystery. I mean, my kids, if they have a question about why they were placed for adoption, or, you know, even little things like why do I like music, they can ask their biological family. They can text them and say, hey, did you like music when you were a kid? Or they can ask questions about their adoption, and they can go straight to the source. So there's no, my husband and I don't have to be the middle people, right, who kind of, you know, we help our kids navigate those feelings, but when they have questions, they can just ask their biological family. So it's been really, really nice and overall very positive.
So aside from the texting, how often do your children actually see their birth families?
So we've done, our kids' birth families live 4 hours from us. So we've done anywhere from 2 times a year to 4 times a year. And that's in-person visits, but we've also done like FaceTime phone calls, for example, which of course isn't the same as an in-person visit, but it's also really nice, the technology that we have available to us today, that, you know, we can text them, we can do a video chat, we can see them in person. It's just, it's really nice, the technology, because it helps us have more openness. Because obviously planning a weekend trip to see 4 birth families, it takes a lot of work in planning and scheduling, and it doesn't always work out. So there's alternatives that help make our relationship work well.
And has the contact with the birth family been a positive experience for your kids? How do they do with it?
Well, I think, and Madeline, I'm sure, can testify to this, and she's taught me a lot about this, Madeline Melcher, who you had on the show. But we just do it case-by-case basis. So we schedule visits based on how each kid is doing and how their birth family is doing and what they need at that time. But overall, it's been extremely positive because, again, they're going to the source. They're not kind of stuck trying to guess what happened. They can just ask their birth family. So there are times where it's been difficult just because traveling is difficult on little kids. And, you know, 4 visits in a weekend is very fast and furious. But what has been amazing, Sandra, is something that, you know, we keep our kids' faces and their birth family stories and everything very private. But I will tell you what's been really cool is the birth family of each kid has taken the other kids under their wing, too. So, yes, their own biological child is very special to them, but they've also been very inclusive of my other kids, which has been, I mean, it's just beautiful to see. It's beautiful to see how our family, little tree, I always say, is like a huge family orchard now. Like, there are a lot of people aren't related to each other in different ways, but we're all like one big family, and it's been really cool for myself and for my kids.
Wow. What about, do the kids ever come away from those visits with, you know, those big questioning feelings? Do they ever feel confused or conflicted?
Not confused, because we are very, very transparent with our kids about everything, not just adoption. Conflicted, also no, because they see all of their parents, their biological parents and us, together in one room, kind of standing united, I guess. And so I don't know that there's feelings of confliction either. Sometimes, yes, adoption in general can be hard because there's issues of a loss and grief that can happen even in the case of domestic infant adoptions. But as a family, we just kind of navigate those, and then we encourage our kids to contact, you know, their biological families if they have questions. And we, you know, my kids don't have phones, but we can supervise their texting by them using our phones and kind of helping guide them through that process. So, I mean, again, overall, it's been really positive, but it's a lot of work. And so I think, you know, I think families need to know that if they're considering an open adoption, is that you have to put forth a lot of effort. It doesn't come easily, but I don't think any great relationship is easy. I think good relationships do take work and commitment.
Yes, and it sounds like the just the whole open communication and then the unity between both families is such a great foundation of support for the children.
Yeah, it is. And it says it's okay that you're adopted. It's okay to love more than one parent. This is all okay. And by us kind of showing up and being in the same room together, we make that very clear visually to our kids as well as tell them, but it's also really powerful to be able to show them.
Wow. So this is a great conversation for our listeners, because I feel like if anybody's considering open adoption, transracial adoption, it's really answering a lot of questions and giving some great advice. And like you said, it's hard. It's a lot of work, but it is so worth it. And it's such wisdom for families who are considering this, because I think a lot of families would consider open adoption scary for the reasons that you mentioned, just like a lot of times foster parents are kind of a little bit leery of the biological family. And a lot of times the biological family gets that, you know, bad rap that they're bad when they're not. They're just in a difficult place. And so it's just that open communication and that unity. I really, really appreciate you sharing about that.
Yeah, and I definitely also advise families that there are times when open adoption is not appropriate. If the birth family is making, you know, really toxic choices that could be harmful to the adoptee, and I mean physically harmful or emotionally harmful, it's okay not to have that openness sometimes, because as the child's parent, we have to make some tough calls. So I definitely don't think people should choose open adoption to any and all extremes. I think that it has to be healthy, and, you know, there has to be boundaries and definitely mutual understanding of what's best for the child. But if it is best for the child to have some openness, then I think it can be a really beautiful thing. So it's just nice that we have all these options now. You know, we can have an open adoption or a semi-open adoption. It can mean a lot of different things, and it's been really good for our family.
Wonderful to hear. So Rachel, as we wrap up, what is on your heart that you really want our listeners to take away from our conversation today?
You know, a message that I tell people a lot of times that I wish I would have known a decade ago is that when we're in adoption, we need to make prayerful, wise decisions. But God also requires action of us, not just sit back and pray and, you know, hope that everything works out, that we need to take action. So I tell families, when you're facing a decision in your adoption of what to do, you need to make decisions out of education, not out of ignorance. Mm. And what I mean by that is, you know, before you decide is open adoption right for us or not, you ask tons of people and you read books and you read articles and you work really hard to make educated decisions, because ignorant decisions are decisions made out of fear, and they are generally not what's best for the adoptee. And when you're a parent, your job is to do what's best for your child who was adopted. So you need to take your job seriously and, you know, pray for that wisdom and really have that, you know, God guidance. But also you need to take action steps and get educated on things before you make important decisions regarding your child and their adoption.
And that's wisdom right there, because I think a lot of times we do make decisions out of fear, and then,
yes,
you know, we're kind of paralyzed and stuck, and it's not what's best. So definitely educated decisions, prayerful decisions, good advice.
Yes.
So anything else, Rachel, before we wrap up? Anything else on your heart?
I'm just obviously very passionate about adoption, and I answer all messages that I get from people if they have questions about domestic infant adoption, open adoption, transracial adoption, how to have an ethical adoption. So if anyone has any questions after listening to this, you're more than welcome to send me a message, and I will do my very best to respond.
Well, thank you, Rachel, for joining us today and for sharing your story with us and for all the advocacy work you do. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for having me today. This was lovely.
Oh, it was my pleasure. And I just want to remind our listeners that Rachel is the author of 6 books, including The Hopeful Mom's Guide to Adoption and a devotional called Encouragement for the Adoption and Parenting Journey, which she co-authored with Madeline Melcher. And Rachel also has a blog that you can check out to learn so much more about some of the topics that we were talking about today. The blog is whitesugarbrownsugar.com. So if you're a transracial, adoptive, or foster parent, or maybe you're considering adoption, you can visit her blog and check out her books too. So if you enjoyed this episode of Orphans No More, you can find more on our website at justicefororphansny.org. And they are now available as podcasts on iTunes. And the name of the show, if you're going to go on iTunes, you're going to look for Orphans No More. That's the name of the show. This is Sandra Flack of Justice for Orphans. Our mission is to rally the church for the cause of the fatherless. We inspire, educate, and equip the body of Christ to walk out James 1:27 by adoption, foster care, and orphan ministry. And if you would like to book me to speak at your church or event, you can contact me right from our website. Again, that's justicefororphansny.org.
Thank you for supporting this program by listening today, sharing what you've heard, and praying for orphans and children in need everywhere. More information is available at justicefororphansny.org. Visit and discover how you can make a difference in a child's life. And be sure to tune in to Orphans No More next Friday.